Today's undisclosed addendum is brought to you by our most delicious sponsor, Blue Apron. And hey, we've got a brand new sponsor, Simply Safe. Make sure you listen in for the spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Enjoy the addendum.
Hello, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I am John Cryer, and you are listening to the podcast about all things undisclosed. We've done about 10 of these addendums so far, so I'm pretty sure you're up to speed on what we're doing here. Basically, we talk about the last episode of Undisclosed, and we also bring on some really cool guests to mull it over and maybe get off on some weird tangential topics. Often the tangential topics are as much fun as the rest of it. So in episode 10 of Undisclosed, Out of Character, we went through the prior difficulties that supposedly went down between Isaac Dawkins and Joey Watkins and how they were used or perhaps misused against him. Now with us today is one of the hosts of Undisclosed, Susan Simpson, ladies and gentlemen. She is an associate of the Volkov Law Group, and this is a part of her bio that I don't generally talk about, which is she actually specializes in the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which to me sounds dirty. It sounds like, what are these foreigners up to? Is it nasty? I don't know. But thank you for being here, Susan.
Glad to be back in the addendum.
And we have a couple of other guests this week. We have Claire Gilbert. She is returning from the Georgia Innocence Project. She's an attorney and the interim director. She blogs at georgiainnocenceproject.org. And prior to the Georgia Innocence Project, she worked several years as a public defender and as a policy lawyer with the Government Accountability Project. Hey there, Claire. Welcome back.
Hello. Thank you. Glad to be here.
And in addition to Claire, we have Bill Rankin. He is a legal affairs reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He covers the federal courthouse in Atlanta, the federal appeals court, and the Georgia Supreme Court. He's worked at the newspaper for 27 years, but he is also the narrator of Breakdown, an Atlanta Journal-Constitution podcast that's now in its second season, and I've been so enjoying it, Bill. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here. Y'all have a great thing going.
Thanks. Now, Bill, you've been following the Ross Harris case on Breakdown. Now, when it first occurred, it was, you know, very sensational. It was in the papers, but it's been kind of out of the national news for a while. So can you tell the listeners a little bit of a background on that case and where it is now?
Sure. Ross Harris was a web guy. He worked at Home Depot just outside of Atlanta. And one morning he took his 22-month-old son, Cooper, to have breakfast at a Chick-fil-A, not far from his work. They had breakfast, and he had to drive about a quarter mile to drop Cooper off at daycare. He had to take a left at a stoplight not far from the Chick-fil-A. Instead, he went straight to his work and parked in his office parking lot and left Cooper in his car for 7 hours, and the temperatures inside the car went way above 100 degrees, and Cooper died. It's a terrible, very sad case. And what came out was, as his son was dying, Ross Harris was sexting with other women during the day. And Cobb County prosecutors are charging him with murder. One of the murder counts says he intentionally left Cooper to die, to essentially live a child-free life and be able to swing whenever he wanted to. And they tried to pick a jury in Cobb County this spring, but there was so much antipathy against Harris from the jurors. There was one juror who said she would agree to give him the death penalty, even though that's not an option in the case. And so they moved the trial down to Brunswick, where I am right now, which is along Georgia's coast. And they're trying to pick a jury right now, and we think we'll have a jury by the end of the week, and the trial should start October 3rd. One thing's interesting is that the news of the case has made it all the way down here. I mean, this is a national story, and I think it's 62 of the 72 jurors so far have said they already knew about the case, and more than half of them already thought he was guilty. One thing's kind of interesting is that when I listened this morning to this week's episode about the evidence that was put up against Joey, is that in the Harris case, they're saying he intentionally killed his son, so they're to show motive, introducing, you know, the prosecutors asked the judge to be able to introduce all this evidence about his sexting, his cheating on his wife, and there is a lot of it. And Harris's defense lawyer objected, saying it was way too prejudicial, but the judge is letting it in. So it reminded me this morning about what happened in Joey Watkins' case. It's a little bit different, but it's bad character evidence. That's what it comes down to.
For me, listening about what Joey's trial was like, it struck me as, well, it's understandable that a fair amount of this is fair context. You know, if you hear a case of a woman who's been stalked for a year and finally she's attacked by somebody, the fact that she was stalked for a year is relevant, you know, even if the actual incident is hard to prove. So where is the line? You know, I don't know how judges draw that line.
I think in Georgia, the line lies in the difference between prior difficulties and similar transactions. So in Georgia, prior difficulties is really about the relationship between the victim and the accused. And that was what the focus of this week's episode was. Next week's episode is all about similar transactions. And that's where a lot of the most severe and damaging character evidence comes in, and stuff that really seems not related or connected at all. But the line in Georgia seems to be that if it is pertaining to interactions between the victim and the accused, then that largely gets to come in pretty much across the board with very little restrictions. They're supposed to be tighter restrictions on what comes in as far as similar transactions are concerned.
But it seems like in the Ross Harris case that those don't apply. Neither one of those seem to apply.
Right. Well, they're just using it to try and show motive. That's exactly right. You know, the judge, Matthews, in the Joey Watkins case, he read that limiting instruction, which tells the jurors they really need to be careful how they considered the evidence. I had to listen to that 3 or 4 times.
Oh, my goodness. Wait, I wrote it down. Wait, I'm going to repeat it to you because I would be baffled. Listen to this. I instruct you that before you may consider any other transaction for the limited purpose I have referred to, you must first determine whether this accused committed the other transaction, and if so, whether any such act was similar enough to the crime charged in this indictment, so that proof of another transaction in light of the limited purpose for which has been presented to you would tend to prove an element of a crime charged in this indictment. What? How is it? I have some point of reference in terms of, you know, I find criminal justice fascinating, so I have some understanding of this. But if I was a lay person on a juror, I mean, I literally had to sentence by sentence parse it out after I wrote it. I wrote it down.
Extremely difficult.
And it's not that there can't be relevance to this kind of information. I mean, especially for prior difficulties. There are obviously cases where that is clear, relevant, important information to understand both the prosecution's evidence and the guilt of the accused. But it also opens the door for so much evidence that I suspect at heart, the prosecutor's motive has nothing to do with proving the crime at issue. It's to prove what a bad person the defendant is. That's really what they're hoping the jury's going to take away. Because look at Joey, well, especially with Ross Harris. I mean, my God, the jump from he had affairs, therefore he didn't want to have children anymore is so bizarre. It's not like there's this like...
Especially when there's so much evidence of how much he loved his son and how many people were coming forward saying his son was the light of his life.
Is there really even like a cultural trope that people who have affairs want to get rid of their kids to have affairs? It's not a thing. Like, people have both all the time.
His ex-wife is going to... An ex-wife who had been cheated on, and I'm just completely humiliated in the national media by his actions while they were married. I think her testimony could be pretty strong, because she's going to say he loved his son. He would never do something like that. That's what I expect her to say.
Didn't the authorities find that he had accessed a website that was about living a child-free life, and that that was what apparently set them off on this particular angle?
No, he checked out a Reddit subreddit, like briefly looked at it and went away again.
That's right. He looked at 3 posts that had nothing to do with living a child-free life, although he did go to the child-free life subreddit, which they say is suspicious.
But again, it seems like that colored the whole investigation.
That's the motive. Their source of motive in this case is that he once looked at a subreddit briefly and went away again.
Also, he was on a what's called a Whisper account with another woman. As he was eating breakfast that morning with his son, his son's last meal, he's trading messages over this anonymous messaging service where the woman said, "I hate being married with kids." And Cobb police have admitted that they initially thought that he wrote that when, in fact, the woman he was texting with wrote that.
Yes, it seems like sometimes misunderstandings send investigators off on a tear that they end up validating through other means, even though the original source information is incorrect. That certainly happened in the Adnan Syed case. It seems like they saw the cell tower pings in Leakin Park and decided, oh, okay, well, let's create our whole case around this thing, this information that turned out later to be basically erroneous.
What's interesting, though, is that did not initially happen in Joey's case. I mean, for obvious reasons, he was an immediate suspect, and the cops looked at him immediately, and then they went, well, this kind of isn't actually, after looking at everything, that's not really matching our initial impression. And they'd started to move on until they went back to the original line of investigation for various reasons.
Well, till the family of Isaac, till they brought in Stanley Sutton, which also mirrors Adnan's case, because I think the introduction of the Inahi Group brief that was sent to police, and apparently the woman who wrote it was on the phone with the police daily, according to her. And clearly, the families involved of the victims in both cases had some effect on the course of the investigation. Is that typical?
I will say it's not. The family's involvement is not particularly relevant, because the family is always, they're going through trauma and grief on a scale that can't be comprehended from daily life. Like, they're, it's typical to have a family that's desperate and pointing whatever they can to try and find an answer for what happened to them. So for me personally, I don't find that relevant. It's what the cops do, what the cops latch onto. That's what matters. It is their job to find what is relevant, to look at that. So the fact that the family might have suggested something, I don't think is really an issue itself.
I certainly don't blame the family or think they're doing anything inappropriate. It's just in these two cases, you know, clearly their intervention had a big effect on the police for whatever set of reasons.
But it can often be the family does know that there's an issue in this person's life, and they can give very good information concerning where to look. So I think it's totally valid for the cops to look at that. It's just they need to make sure that there's actually an evidentiary basis for pursuing it.
All right, shout out to all of our listeners participating in the Undisclosed Blue Apron Cook-Off. Blue Apron's got some delicious stuff for you to choose from this week. So far, I've enjoyed Basque-style cod, seared chicken and caramelized vegetables, and my personal favorite, the pork chops and spicy chow chow. It was delicious, but I more so liked it because I got to say chow chow while I was cooking and eating it. We've loved the pictures of the dishes that you've been cooking and sending to us at our handle, UndisclosedPod. And we know Blue Apron loves it because they told us so. They've reached out and said, hey, thanks. It's very cool to see Blue Apron chefs tweeting about the great dishes they're making at home. So keep that up. If you haven't gotten in on the Undisclosed Blue Apron Cook-Off, you can still do so. You're going to have a lot of fun getting in on the cook-off, especially if you've got a family. Blue Apron knows that cooking together builds strong household bonds. And hey, look, if you buy the family-style portion, you can get great meals at less than 10 bucks per meal. So come on, if you haven't done so already, get down on the Undisclosed Blue Apron Cook-Off. Here's how you do it. Go to www.blueapron.com/UP, that UP is for Undisclosed Podcast. You sign up at that URL, you get 3 meals free with free shipping. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. Go to www.blueapron.com/UP. Blue Apron, it's a better way to cook.
So in terms of when they are introducing all this other evidence of prior difficulties and such, does the entire responsibility of keeping that out fall on the defense attorney?
And the judge.
Right. The judge is supposed to decide whether or not the evidence is showing motive, intent, or state of mind. But if there's concerns about it, the defense attorney needs to raise an objection. They don't even need a pretrial hearing on issues of prior difficulties.
Was there a pretrial hearing on this issue?
They did have a pretrial hearing on the issue of similar transactions, and they did talk a bit about the prior difficulties, but very briefly. It was almost as if Tammy Colston was like, I'm doing this just out of the kindness of my heart, just mentioning that this stuff is going to come up, even though the law doesn't require me to give notice or us to discuss this in advance.
So a prosecutor is free to just bring this up, you know, on an individual basis. They don't in any way have to give any warning that these are issues that they're going to bring up in the course of the trial?
That is my understanding from reviewing the law and the facts surrounding this particular case.
So that brief that was read where they were saying exactly which they intended to bring up, that was not something that they have to do. They just did that as a some sort of gesture.
Well, there's two issues here. There's the prior difficulties and the prior similar transactions.
The prior difficulties is what is between the victim and the suspect. And that is what they do not need a full-blown hearing on. The similar transactions gets a lot more into the risk of bringing in overly prejudicial character evidence, and that is what you do need the hearing on. So there was a hearing on that, and prior to that hearing beginning, Tammy Colston brought up, I'm also bringing in prior difficulty evidence, and this is what it is, but they didn't really do any kind of hearing on that.
And also, one of the charges against Joey in this case was the crime of stalking. So that was sort of a loophole that they could use to get in a lot of evidence that seems otherwise irrelevant by saying, oh, it's evidence not for the murder necessarily. It's evidence that Joey was stalking Isaac, with knowing full well that the jury's also going to use it as evidence of murder.
Well, just out of curiosity, did the defense ever point out that specifically since the charge is stalking, the fact that Isaac followed him as much as he followed Isaac would seem to completely mitigate that? Did the defense ever bring that up?
In a respectful sort of muted fashion, which I understand why they have to do that, because, again, that is a very hard defense to raise. You have this kid who was murdered horribly, and to get there in front of a jury and say, yeah, but he was chasing this violent defendant around, yeah, it's a hard sell. So I understand why that would not be something they'd want to play up particularly.
Yeah, they did do it in a very kind of subtle way. In fact, the first time I read through the transcript, I thought that Bill O'Dell did a pretty good job with it, particularly with Jay Barnett, who was one of the first witnesses in the trial. He very respectfully, through his questioning, got out that it was Isaac who was following Joey on the incident pertaining to where they went to Joey's house. And I thought he did a good job on that, but they didn't sort of wrap it up and tie it together and hammer it home for exactly the reason Susan just said and that Joey talked about in the episode.
Well, because actually none of the incidents to me actually read like stalking behavior. None of them. You know, can you guys think of one?
There isn't. It just didn't happen.
You know what's frustrating to me as a listener, and I'm listening very closely to Joey Watkins' tale, is that we can't hear the trial testimony. And I think if you could, you would certainly have a much deeper understanding of whether these people are telling the truth or not. It's very frustrating that the court is not allowing the recording to be released.
And plus, there's also the risk that I don't know how to avoid, that when I'm there reading a transcript and speaking for one of these witnesses, I'm going to read things and like imply something different or like somehow project my interpretation onto their words, which isn't fair to them either.
Right. I don't understand why they're doing this. I mean, I know that there's a case right now. There's a lawyer, Ashley Merchant. She's actually provided some commentary on the Breakdown podcast. She was in a court in Douglas County before a longtime Superior Court Judge David Emerson, and she was representing a client. She said during the hearing, Judge Emerson treated her terribly, with no respect whatsoever, and that the tone and demeanor of the way he talked would clearly show how inappropriately he behaved. So she asked to get the court recording of that hearing. And if I recall, Emerson said his court reporter is a contractor, and so it's not essentially a public record. The transcript is. He offered Ashley Merchant the opportunity to come to the courthouse and listen to the recording of that hearing, but she couldn't copy it, which I guess I don't know what good that would have done. So Merchant sued the judge and the court reporter. Their case went to a judge in Fulton County, which is home of Atlanta, because that's where the court reporter lives. The judge there dismissed the case, and now it's up on appeal to the Georgia Supreme Court. And it seems like as all this is going on, all the judges around Georgia have closed ranks, and they're not releasing what is arguably a public record, which is the recording of a trial or a court hearing in a public courtroom. So I'm, as somebody who makes podcasts, I'm extremely interested in how the Georgia Supreme Court rules. I think they should rule sometime this year, I would hope.
Yes. This goes way beyond just Joey's case.
Yeah, it's just so odd. They did the same thing in Joey's case in that they said, you can come and listen to it yourself if you would like, but you can't copy it. It's like, you can come and look at these documents. The documents are open for you to come and see. You can write down what's on the documents, but you can't make a copy of the documents. I mean, that would be absurd, but this is the equivalent in sound. It makes no sense.
If I was a news organization and I wanted to cover Joey's trial, I would have to file what's called a Rule 22, which is what you need to file in a Georgia courtroom to get access to videotape or record a trial if you're a TV station or a radio station. So if that had been done at that time, you know, and the trial had been covered, somebody would have a copy of it somewhere. And I'm sure they would make it available. But now, because the trial's over, it's too late. It's very troubling to me, you know, because public court, you know, the open court is a fundamental bedrock principle that we have, that courts need to be open. So I'm very interested to see what the Georgia Supreme Court does. And maybe we'll hear a lot about Joey's trial at some point.
Yeah. And it's not just a media issue either, too. I think it's a very fundamental right for defendants. I just spoke to an exoneree in a different state, not Georgia. But in his case, the judge gave a pretty outlandish instruction to the jury. The transcripts did not have it. The transcripts did not show this instruction being made in the way the judge did it. And when they tried to get the audio, they couldn't. And then, oops, the audio got destroyed. My bad. So they ended up having to get 11 affidavits from people in the courtroom who heard the judge say this in order to prove that, yeah, the transcript didn't show it because his court reporter did him a favor, but the judge said it.
It sounds to me like an abuse of, you know, the fact that they just happened to have a private contractor as the stenographer, because I don't know what purpose protecting the recording would do for the stenographer. I don't know. There's no professional purpose not releasing that would accomplish.
I can think of two reasons.
Oh, thank you. Okay, good.
Well, when I first tried to get courtroom proceeding for the first breakdown episode, which was of a case out of West Georgia of a man wrongly convicted of murder, he had a habeas hearing down in South Georgia where he was in prison. And I called the court reporter and asked her if I could come down and tape record the habeas hearing. And I felt like I was talking to Charlton Heston. You know, I wasn't going to get it out of her cold, dead hands. I mean, really, she said, you're going to have to go to the Supreme Court to get it to me. And she essentially hung up on me. And it took a lot of coaxing and a very nice judge to finally allow us to go down there and record it. And I don't see what in the world could have gone wrong. But I think maybe the court reporter was worried that I was going to try to check and see if, you know, what she had put down in the transcript was right or not. That was not my intention. I kept telling her that. But I think that could be one reason. And the other reason is more disturbing is that maybe some judges don't want people to hear what goes on in their courtroom, and they control, you know, the judges truly control whether things are going to be released or not. Yeah.
That is the disturbing thing. In this case, there is no other possible issue. There isn't a valid reason I can think of for why they would not want to release the audio here. I mean, we have the transcripts. We're not going to put the reporter out of a job. The reporter's not the one objecting here. Basically, they're saying that it is somehow against the interest of the state to let people hear what a judge says in court or what witnesses say in court?
Well, it seems to me like the state is using basically what private attorneys do, which is just placing impediments in front of the opposition, which to me is immoral for the state to do. I know it puts them at a disadvantage in terms of courts, but it's not their job to make it hard on the defense. It's just not.
Or more disturbingly, possibly, what if this is something that's been going on for a while? And I've at least heard claims. There's obviously no way to evaluate it because we can't get the audio. But in other cases, that this is something that happens, that judges repair their mistakes by glossing over in the transcripts what happened. And if they've come to rely on that, if they don't allow the audio to ever get out, no one's ever going to know it.
And I thought it might be some, when they initially started raising these concerns, putting my conspiracy theories aside, I thought it might be some kind of proprietary issue. Like Susan just mentioned, you know, if anyone can request the audio of a trial and then perhaps go and have someone else prepare the transcript, and that potentially puts a court reporter out of a job. But here, the transcript has already been prepared. They offered us another copy of the transcript for free. And we also offered to pay for the audio itself, if that was the issue. And none of that was acceptable.
How did you get the audio of the Mark Free trial?
Well, that's a long and complicated story. But the brief version is that we asked for it over and over and over and over again. And then we offered to pay to have it transcribed, to get the transcript of it, because we at least needed to. We were trying to find out if the audio still existed or if the tapes had been destroyed. And so in the course of locating the tapes to see how much the transcript would cost, the court reporter just decided to give us those tapes. Yeah.
It's worth noting. So I remember, Claire, when you called me, you were like, I have all the tapes from the Mark Free trial. Is that okay?
Yeah. I had to call. I had to confer with like three different lawyers before leaving the courthouse because it felt very strange to be leaving the courthouse with dozens of original trial tapes.
Did you think you were going to be accused of theft or something?
I just felt, you know, that when in Rome, like I was like, well, you know, we've got all this beef with the state and the police for not preserving evidence. And here I'm about to walk out of the courthouse with, you know, 20 trial tapes in my purse. Like it just felt wrong. But I documented it all in the courthouse. I documented everything in writing. We're keeping them in, you know, a secure location here. I told the court reporter if she ever needed them back, we would give them back to her. And the issue there was that they could have been destroyed at any time because there was no requirement for her to preserve them because it was a not guilty verdict.
And to give some backstory here, there has been in previous attempts to obtain information from the court and from the police and DA. At one point, there was an incident where Claire was accused of stealing and like hiding the police department's evidence. So I know that was something that Claire was rightfully being aware of.
Right. Well, not so much stealing, but borrowing.
Like, yes. And not borrowing and not returning.
No. They said that I did return it. That was the odd thing. They said that I took it away and then
stealing and, thing.
But Claire, and then they only said that after they said, oh, we don't have the file anymore, and you're the last one to take it.
Right, right.
She never had it in the first place.
Oh.
So what happened was when they made the copies of the police file for me, they returned both the copies and the originals and asked me to match them to make sure they got all the copies correct. So I did. And in the course of doing that, I got like three pages of an original mixed up with the copy. So the next time I went back to Rome, I returned those three pages of the original. And then I went back again to copy some more of Stanley Sutton's police file notes. And this time, when I looked in the file, 100% of Stanley Sutton's police file notes were no longer in the file. Someone had gone in and removed them all. And so I asked about this. I said, you know, one of the pages of Stanley Sutton's notes got cut off. That was a page referring to Yvonne Agin, who's a major witness in this case, and I wanted to copy it correctly. And his notes are gone. So can you ask whoever took them to put them back? And the police department told me that there was a witness or that I had a witness to me being the one who removed all the police notes, and that their understanding is that I had taken them. But the strange thing is that they then reappeared on the officer's desk a few days later with a note that said that these had been returned by Claire Gilbert, which is not true because I didn't take them and I didn't return them. And when I asked the secretary about it at the police department, she said that wasn't correct either, that the only time I had returned anything were those three pages at the very beginning that had got accidentally mixed in.
You are not a good thief at all.
I know.
You're a terrible thief. You have to work on that, Claire.
And the motive is all wrong there, too.
Yes.
Like that matters in Rome, Georgia.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, it begs the question, why were you asking for them in the first place?
Exactly.
What thief steals something and then goes back and says, hey, where's the... I guess if you're a brilliant thief, you see, that's the thing. Actually, you're a sociopath. It all makes sense now.
That's right.
So I love it when I've got this problem that I just, for the life of me, can't figure out how to solve. And I get frustrated and it makes me just want to quit the problem. And then a solution comes along that just makes everything seem right. And I think to myself, why didn't I find out about this sooner? So that happened to me recently when it came to the home security system I was using. I was with one of the big home security providers and I was under contract. And I felt like I just couldn't get the system to work. I'd punch in my access code and it would do the thing where I was invalid, and it was just so inconvenient. So I ended up cutting the contract with the home security system I was with, and I was without a system for a bit. And I was worried, you know, because I want to protect my stuff. But then one of them great solutions came along, and that solution is SimpliSafe. Here's what's great about SimpliSafe. No contracts. None. You get award-winning 24-hour, 7-day-a-week protection that has been named the best in the industry. And for that kind of quality, it's just $14.99 per month. So here it is. Protect your home the smart way. All you got to do is go to simplysafeundisclosed.com. You go right now. You're also going to get free shipping on your order. Not only that, but the order will come with a free keychain remote. A keychain's worth $25, but if you go to that URL, you're going to get it for free. One more time, that link, it's simplysafeundisclosed.com. Go check out SimpliSafe, folks.
We have a few Twitter questions that actually I wanted to get into. When you guys were talking about the various incidents that were used as prior difficulties, by the way, prior difficulties to me are like when I can't open a jar of peanut butter. You know, and this kind of stuff seemed a little more serious than that. But there seemed to be a lot of confusion about the death of Isaac's dog, Sally, because at one point in the podcast, you state that they never found the body, which to me, you know, a couple of people said, you know, how do you know that the dog is even dead if you never found the body?
Well, Isaac returned home one day and he found the dog and he went and buried the dog right after he found it. No one else ever saw it. But he told friends and family that when he'd gotten home, he'd found her shot in her pen. And after his death, his friends and family told that to the police.
How did they know it was a .22?
That's the $64,000 question.
Let's just say that it's an issue that will be explored in detail later.
Look forward to it.
But since he buried the dog, there's no way to possibly, you know, exhume the dog, I would imagine.
There would be a way to exhume the dog if they could find the dog. And he apparently told his mom where they buried the dog. They apparently looked for the dog extensively on their property and at this other location where he supposedly buried the dog. But our understanding from the state is that they never found the dog. They never dug the dog up. They should have no idea what the dog was shot with.
It seems like people that Isaac talked to remember different things about what he said about where he buried the dog. So they reported different things. And it had been a few months at that point, so they just probably had forgotten. But the end result was that no one could agree on where Isaac said he'd buried the dog.
I'm confused. Did the state actually look for the dog or just...
Yes.
Oh, okay.
They didn't find it.
The police actually made an effort to do that. Okay.
And apparently the FBI, too. Well, the FBI apparently came out to the property to look for the bullet that should have been in the dog's head. So I'm not quite sure why they were looking for a bullet on the property. But they were trying to find any sign of the type of weapon that was used to kill Sally.
So at one point it had been said that the Georgia Bureau of Investigation had been involved with this. But I did not realize that the FBI was involved as well.
They were.
Neither did we. We thought it might be a misprint or something misspoken, but they were indeed involved, which is a very interesting story that I'm sure will come up.
Yeah, I totally thought it was just GBI. I was like, oh, they meant GBI. It's confusing. Lots of acronyms. And Claire's like, I'm not so sure about that.
Well, that's one thing, Susan. A lot of the time you look over these documents extensively and intensively. And I find when I'm reading these documents, there's so much stuff that I gloss over. I go, oh, probably somebody just made a notation error or something like that. Do you, every time something jiggles you a little bit, do you look into everything?
I wish. I try to. But in this case, I mean, I didn't miss it. I saw it says FBI, but I totally said, oh, of course they meant GBI, which was a mistake.
And the thing that struck me about that was that it was Stanley Sutton who said it. And it seems like the police themselves wouldn't mix up GBI and FBI. He said it a couple of places.
But the transcriber might. Again, we need the trial audio.
Right.
Right.
But again, I don't know why the FBI would have jurisdiction over this.
Oh, they found a way.
Oh, good.
Where there's a will, there's a way.
Yes, if they like called internationally at one point or something, or, you know, there's always, you know, some angle. It's like the DEA being involved in a Adnan Syed's case. It's like, I understand all law enforcement is sort of on the same team, but why these things need to take the course they take is absolutely a mystery to me. And again, it argues in favor of my big idea for the podcast, which is just make them all one thing. let's not have sheriffs and cops and this and that and FBI, just all one, just police. They can all just be police and they can all be together and work together and be happy people and everything's perfect.
John Cryer's utopia.
I know. Yes, exactly.
One of the things that really struck me about this first 1A in the notice of intent to raise similar transaction, which was the notice about the dog. Susan brought it up in the episode that the notice that Tammy Colston gave was that between June of 1999 and August of 1999, Isaac Dawkins' dog was shot, and that the dog was shot because Isaac Dawkins was dating Breanne Scarborough. That is the time frame during which June 1999 to August 1999, Tammy Colston was under the understanding that Isaac and Breanne had dated. Tammy sent an email to Isaac's mom 1.5 months prior to filing this notice of intent to raise similar transaction. And the subject of the email was similar transaction evidence. So Tammy is sending an email to Isaac's mom asking her specifically about similar transaction evidence. And what we have is the response. So the copy that we have says similar transaction evidence. And that response from Isaac's mom addresses information about the dog. So clearly Tammy had asked about the dog so she could write about it in the similar transaction evidence. And Francine says the dog was shot on October 1st, a Friday. So why Tammy, with this very clear information saying that the dog was shot October 1st from the source, turns around and says that the dog, under penalty of perjury in a document she files with the court, that the dog was shot between the eyes between June of 1999 and August of 1999 when Isaac and Breanne were dating, is disturbing to me.
There's a lot that's disturbing about this notice. It's not just that one's more glaring and upsetting because she asked a question, got an answer, and then ignored it. But there are a lot of times in this notice that, to me, it looks like she genuinely didn't know what she was talking about. She was not intentionally distorting something. She just didn't have a clue. And yet she just went right ahead and presented this, like, narrative of something that Joey had done that there's not a witness saying. It's not like she's even listening to a witness and, like, getting it wrong. Because the witness got it wrong. She's just listing bad things Joey did and not caring if there's any truth to it.
Did Joey's defense attorney confront her about this?
You know, they got this notice in June, and the trial started in June. So it's not even like they had a lot of time to figure this out. It took me a lot longer than 2 weeks to figure this out. And I have all the records to look at.
Well, that's what occurred to me, is there's so many incidents. I mean, there's 5 incidents, as you said. And a defense attorney has to bat down every single one. It just seems like it's putting an enormous pressure on the defense. And I guess, you know, obviously it's in the judge's purview whether it should go that way. But, you know, I don't know how you're supposed to marshal that amount. It's throwing everything but the kitchen sink at the defendant. I don't know how that's fair.
Yeah, there's actually 20 incidents raised in this notice of similar transaction provided to the defense 2 weeks before trial.
Bill, is this something you've seen a lot in Georgia in cases other than ones in the podcast, the ones you report on for the paper?
Well, I do see a lot of cases with similar transaction evidence, and it does seem like they come fairly late in the process and how defense attorneys have to scramble. I mean, just think if you're a public defender and you have 200 cases and you don't have an investigator, and all of a sudden you get a notice, you know, let's say a month before trial, of similar transactions. How in the world do you have the time and the resources to investigate all these incidents? It's beyond me. If you have a well-funded defense, you know, you have a lawyer or two, and they have a maybe one or two investigators, maybe they can scramble in time and check it out. You know, with the internet now, you can find out a whole lot of things. But I've seen lawyers who have been cross-examining witnesses on the stand with, with Giglio and Brady? In some instances, you get to get it on cross-examination, you know, the notice, and you get the evidence. So I've seen lawyers cross-examining a witness while a co-counsel will be on the internet trying to find holes in what they were just received in court. It doesn't seem that fair to me, but that's the way it plays out often.
That's jinx material, and the defendant does not have a right to it until after the direct examination of the witness.
Yes.
And in this case, there were 101 named state's witnesses. You know, they brought forward this notice of intent to raise similar transaction with 20 different incidents in here. It was 3 weeks before trial. And there was never a continuance in this case. This case went to trial on its very first trial setting.
Well, also, the defense didn't see much of this coming because so many of the witnesses seem to have changed their story. Is there any way to see that, except, I guess, once they're on the stand? That's when you get word that they've changed their story. Were the defense attorneys privy to their witness statements, their original witness statements?
Some of them. They didn't have the first ones because they didn't have the notes from the, but they had like the recorded transcripts.
Right.
And Claire, I don't know if you had a similar experience, but when I finally realized I got to know the case well enough to actually kind of see the bigger picture and to realize that all of these stories came out after Sutton, I was kind of blown away because Mosher was investigating for 7 weeks, and he was being thorough. He was looking into things. He was talking to people. And no one mentions that these really terrible things Joey did to Isaac. Why would his friends and family not disclose this to the police investigating the case?
Right. I cannot even begin to approximate how many hours I've spent on this case. And I didn't realize till I heard you talk about it in the podcast last night. I mean, that's how. And then all of a sudden I was like, whoa, that's right. And, you know, it's only a couple months in, but because Mosher had talked with these people, a lot of his conversations were described in his notes. I just hadn't realized that the brunt of these allegations came out really only after Sutton had gotten involved. It's very powerful.
Have you guys been able to talk to any of these witnesses whose stories changed?
They never seem to want to talk to us for some reason.
Well, yeah, obviously there's that moment where Sutton prompts him with the pool reference. But that, when I listened to it, it didn't immediately ring an alarm bell for me. But again, I'm a layman, only because, you know, people sometimes forget names. They forget to, they've perhaps told a story before, and there's an element of it that they didn't relate the second time. So did the context of that really bother you?
Well, that actually wasn't even the episode originally, as we had in the outline. And as we were recording, I brought it up. It's kind of a throwaway comment between takes. So like, oh, Jez know that like Sutton has to help whisper answers to Jay to help him remember. And they were like, we're adding that now. So it's not that that information itself is critical. But what it does show for me, what was so striking and glaring about it, is it shows how comfortable this witness was with trying to whisper an off-the-record question in the middle of a taped interview to the lead detective. So if he's willing to do that in an interview, what's he doing when the tape's off?
Well, and that's the other thing. You've got Isaac's best friend who ends up, by the time of trial, being a new officer in the police department with Stanley Sutton, who is obviously a very senior officer, a very persuasive and powerful officer, and very, very committed to Joey's guilt. And I just can't imagine what pressures Jay Barnett might have been facing at the time.
Is he still a police officer?
He is.
So I imagine he's not talking to you either.
So Adam Elrod, whose testimony y'all have kind of torn apart, it seems to me, what did he have to gain by coming forward?
I think the large reward was a motivating factor for a lot of these people. There were posters plastered all over Rome. There were billboards. It's up in the jail. It was on everybody's mind that this reward that started at $10,000 and went up to $15,000 and then $20,000 and may have gone up even higher than that, according to some people with whom we've spoken. I think that for several people, that played a role.
Mm-hmm. I think there was a carrot and a stick going on. witnesses had reasons to be motivated to talk, both for gain and to avoid certain risks.
Right.
That reminds me of the Justin Chapman case in the first season of Breakdown, where two key witnesses basically did him in with very questionable testimony, and they both split a reward 3 weeks after the trial. It was never disclosed.
And we can't even find out here what happened to the reward. So we're still looking into that.
So there's no records of whether it's been disbursed yet or not?
There's no, this is not a Crime Stopper sort of, there's no organization here that handles reward, no formal one. So there's not even like an entity responsible for you knowing where it went. It's a black box of money that went somewhere, possibly. It had to go somewhere. I mean, unless it's just still sitting there somewhere.
Yeah, there was a lot of social media anger directed toward Adam Elrod. As a matter of fact, here's at G. Mangine, who says, Adam Elrod is as much to blame for Joey's conviction as Brianne. And it does strike me that, you know, unfortunately, he's got Brianne, he's got Josh Flemster, and he's got Adam Elrod. And it just seems like, well, now it's amazing that he had a shot at all, considering that so many people seemed willing to say awful things about him.
And I don't think it's fair to blame Adam necessarily, because I think Adam is the one who suffers from his own issues. And he was just a super convenient tool for the prosecution to use.
Yeah. That's very generous of you, Susan.
We've gotten some general questions, like James Wyrick, who is the host of the Undisclosed Military Justice podcast that just dropped, asked, why do the young males of Rome spend so much time in displays of machismo? This might be rhetorical. But you went into it a little bit on the podcast, which is that teenagers don't have much to do in this town. I want to say, by the way, I've gotten a certain amount of ire on social media because I referred to Rome a couple of times as a small town. And several people said, no, this is a, you know, we've got a hospital and universities. And so my apologies, first of all.
I have to feel like there's some level of defensiveness going on there because Rome is not tiny. It's like, it's a legit thing. It's got, I mean, it's got Barry College and it's got a good hospital system. But I think people from Atlanta, for instance, would call Rome a small town.
I'm in Atlanta, so I live in Atlanta right outside. And you also need to think that this was almost 20 years ago. So I would think Rome has probably grown a little bit since then. I mean, it has a minor league baseball team. And I guess when you're up on the mountains, when you're up high, you can see it kind of spreads out a pretty good bit. But downtown's very compact and small. It's not, you know, it's not substantial in any way.
I think another good word for Rome is isolated, because it does have that feeling. It's difficult to get to. It's off of main highways. And I think that might be a bit of a factor here as well.
So you feel like the teenagers don't feel like they socially have mobility in terms of going to other towns or feeling like they're part of another community. They kind of just have to stew in their own issues.
I just think it makes it a lot more interconnected. And it does possibly have a more of a small town feel than necessarily its size might suggest. But I just think it's all a matter of where you live, what you're used to, what you call small and not small towns.
Well, my mom grew up in a very rural small town in Indiana, and all the teenagers had to do there was drink and crash into things with their cars. That was like the entirety of their after school activities. Or they would occasionally steal farm equipment and crash that. It was very much a footloose situation. But nowadays, my son is 16 and, you know, his day is incredibly scheduled. You know, and I think part of that is a reaction to teenagers when they don't have anything to do, end up doing things that they probably shouldn't. And may I suggest for the town of Rome, maybe it's time to get a community theater production of Hairspray going for the teenagers. I'm spitballing here, folks. Just something. Yeah.
It's amazing how many of the stories from when they're a bit younger, but like so many of the stories from these kids when they were kids involve going to the skating rink. I mean, when I was like a little kid, we used to go to Sparkles for like skating parties. But when these kids are like teenagers, they're still going to skating rink, which I found kind of odd. Just from my perspective, growing up not too far away in Atlanta.
But they have the machines that give you the tickets. And once you get the tickets, you can take the tickets up and trade them for some cool stuff.
No, I mean like skating. Like Xanadu style. Is that the right movie?
Yes. Roller disco. Yeah. No. That Xanadu is a great reference. Roller boogie. Another good one.
Yeah.
We don't have to go through the whole canon of roller disco movies at this moment. But yes, I find that teenagers will, you know, they'll gather at Shakey's Pizza. They gather wherever they don't feel like they're a problem necessarily. You know, but
being watched.
Exactly.
Bill, I had a podcasting question for you since you're kind of doing a going through similar stuff as we are, and I'm sure the state of Georgia is loving the fact they now have two podcasts focused on criminal justice problems in their state, and there could easily be more. Did you have like any sort of internal discussion in choosing an active case to be the one you followed? Because I saw when you chose that, and it's an interesting case, but I remember thinking, wow, that's brave. Because trying to follow an active case with a podcast seems like, one, hard, and two, just so unpredictable.
Well, I have to say the comfort level of doing one where I had been able to research a case for about 6 months, as opposed to doing one as it's ongoing, was dramatically different. I didn't know how this would play out. I mean, as the trial goes on, I'm going to try to put a podcast together every Monday, which is kind of overwhelming because I'll be writing about the case as it goes on as well for the newspaper. Thankfully, I have a colleague, Christian Boone, who's here with me. But I think what we saw was the interest in this case was over the roof. So I was a little wary before I started, but quite wary when I started. But the more I've delved into this case, the more I've been fascinated by it. And, you know, if anything this podcast has done, if it's raised awareness of telling people they need to think about their kids in the backseat, I feel like I've accomplished more than I could ever accomplish if I could help a parent remember their child.
Just out of curiosity, are they, when they're interviewing potential jurors, are they asking if they've heard the podcast?
They have. In Cobb, I think maybe one or two did. Down here, I haven't heard. Most people say they have listened to Making a Murderer or looked at the OJ case when they're asked about legal documentaries. One thing did come up that was kind of funny down here. So it's in Brunswick. Over the summer, over 8 weeks, in the classified ad section, somebody had taken out an ad under the heading Reasonable Doubt. And it said, if you're interested in the Ross Harris case that's coming here, please listen to Breakdown. And I did not take out that ad. But, but the Cobb County DA's office was so concerned about it, they filed a subpoena to the Brunswick News advertising director demanding that he show up in court with the name of the person who took it out, where the person lived, and how much he paid for the ad. And the newspaper got with its lawyers, and they realized this wasn't a journalism protection, like you're protecting a confidential source. This was a business transaction, so they actually turned over the name of the person who took out the ad. And the Cobb DA told me that once they found out this person wasn't involved in the case or was a Glynn County juror, they dropped it immediately. I'd still like to know who took out the ad.
Me too. Now, does it feel to you like you have a very, very special responsibility? Because I listened to the podcast and I came away with a very specific feeling about the case. Not necessarily that you, that the way that you built it convinced me of that. I don't know if that's what you were going for or not. But do you feel a special responsibility to not, you know, foist a particular view of the case on people?
Yes, my primary responsibility in my mind is to be fair to both sides and to present both of their positions as completely as I possibly can. As I do with all the stories I write for the newspaper, which I've been doing for, as you said, I just had my 27th anniversary. I take that responsibility incredibly serious. It's to my soul.
Yes, I've spoken with some journalists who feel a certain amount of frustration that objectivity is so required because, you know, it often gives equal value to things that, you know, when you're actually in the room, don't have equal value. You'll see, you know, one witness who just seems unbelievable, but what they say you have to report. And I have spoken to journalists who have some frustration about that, but obviously the need for to have objective journalists outweighs that frustration, I would imagine.
It does to me. Absolutely.
Yeah. And we've got one other social media question that I wanted to pose. This is from The Stig Norway, who is Norwegian. As a non-American, the police and legal system in U.S. seems completely insane. Do you feel the same? And I thought in the middle of all this, that's actually, you know, I thought about it for a moment and I thought, you know what? No, it doesn't. You know, it's a process that's gotten very convoluted, but it doesn't feel that way to me. Do you guys feel the same?
Flawed is not insane. And I also suspect that, well, not even suspect, this is not a U.S. thing. There are countries out there that have definitely gotten more together than we do. But the idea this is a U.S. problem is very short-sighted. This is not something that only happens in the U.S. system, in the common law system, or even like outside of developed countries. There are, I'm sure, plenty of countries in Europe where this is happening all the time, and perhaps gets even less exposure than does here in the States.
I would agree that it is flawed. But I think the most wonderful thing about our justice system is that for the most part, it's open. So if it is flawed, you can expose it and corrections can be made. They're not always made, but they can be made. And people respond, you know, when the light shines on them sometimes. So I think that is a very redeeming factor of our justice system.
What can be seen can be fixed. Absolutely.
Yeah, I also agree. I'm a believer in the system, and I think it has flaws and can be improved, but the potential is there, and it just takes people being diligent and open-minded, and it can work.
Yeah.
So release the tape of the audio state of Georgia. How about that? How about that?
Yes.
And it points out the huge issue of privatizing any services in the criminal justice system with prisons and obviously court reporters. That can't be a dodge to transparency.
Right. And also you think about this old equipment, which I guess you probably found. They have four tracks. These stenographers would have four tracks. They would have four microphones across the courtroom. It's very antiquated, but now it's all becoming digitized. So it's going to be so simple, you know, to share it. You know, it's modern technology. Things are made much more efficient and easy, and that's the way this is becoming.
Yeah, it's almost like the courts are saying, like, oh, yeah, we were founded on this ideal of open courts and scrutiny to the public. But it was also really difficult for the public to actually scrutinize it. Now that it's easy for the public to scrutinize it, we don't really want to have it so open anymore.
Right. Very true.
That's right.
Well, we got seven justices on the Georgia Supreme Court. We'll see what they say.
Well, thank you guys so much. This has been great once again. Such a pleasure. Thank you, Claire. And once again, I want to give a shout out to the Georgia Innocence Project. And if you're thinking about donating to a criminal justice related organization, they're a great one. They're not working out of the strip mall anymore. Or are you?
I heard it was strip mall.
Okay, it's a different strip mall.
We're
in a much better quality strip mall now.
We're not working out of the nail salon anymore.
Yes.
But we're still in a strip mall.
You're not by the bowling alley.
We are by the bowling alley. Okay. We're in the basement. We're in the basement of a strip
That's
mall.
Basement of a strip mall.
I'm sure it's very quiet there and good for her.
Oh, yes.
I'd like to also give a shout out to Kaplan Cobb, who is helping Undisclosed with the lawsuit and with the motion to get the trial audio. Mike Kaplan was also the attorney that you heard on Bill's podcast, Season 1 of Breakdown, represented Justin Chapman.
Is there any way that the listeners can support this? Like, can they email a public servant of some kind? Or is there any way that they can help?
Listen to the audio when we get it.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm thinking, you know, sometimes you can write a strongly worded email, you know, because those work.
Yeah. Well, in this case, I think we give the court system a chance to work it out. And hopefully we'll have at least just a fair... Right now, they're not even giving a reason why they can't give it over. So I think we'll give them a chance to actually articulate that and see where we go from there.
And it is the state attorney general's decision on what to do with these trial tapes. They're the lawyers for the courts. So I can't imagine that people expressing their sentiment to the attorney general would hurt.
So do it, people. Okay, well, thank you guys so much. Thank you, Bill. It's truly a pleasure to speak with you and meet you. We'd love to have you guys back anytime you want to come back.
Thank you
so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, John.
Okay, bye-bye, guys. So that wraps up this week's addendum, and I'm actually going to change it up a little bit this week and highlight a slightly different criminal justice-related charity. This is the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. It's a national coalition, and it's a clearinghouse that coordinates, develops, and supports efforts to implement fair and age-appropriate sentences for youth. They provide technical assistance on strategic communications, litigation, and advocacy for attorneys, advocates, organizers, and others working at the state and federal levels. They also work to build a national coalition that supports age-appropriate alternatives to life without parole sentences for children. And you can find them on the web at fairsentencingofyouth.org. And they were brought to us by Dawn Estes. So thank you, Dawn. Fans can discuss the show on Twitter at #undisclosed or #justiceforjoey. And if you want to tag questions for future addenda, you can use #UDAddendum, or you can tweet them directly to me at Mr. John Cryer. Also, again, if you've got a worthy organization, get it to me. We've still got 10 episodes of this to do, and there's a lot of people that I would love to help raise some money. So please let me know. As always, there's going to be new case documents and photos posted at undisclosed-podcast.com, so check that out. And you can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at handle @UndisclosedPod. And also our key partner, the Georgia Innocence Project of Claire Gilbert fame, at GA Innocence. Gonna thank Hannah McCarthy once again and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media, although it's been a while since I talked to Rebecca and I miss her. But they do wonderful audio production and we are so grateful for it. Shout out to Patrick Cortez. Thank you, Patrick Cortez. I never tire of the music and our beautiful addenda theme. And thank you to Methil Telhan, our project manager, once again. And thank you for listening. This has been a great experience for me. I love being a part of this, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again next week. Hey, Susan, long time no speak.
I know.
Did you have a nice week off?
I was exiled for a bit. No, it's going to be bad.
We're done with you, Susan.
Yeah. Bad podcaster.
Yes, bad podcaster.